Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. I'm Senator Mia Costello, and I'd like to welcome Senator Stevens. Good afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Machicki. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Today is February 13th, 2018, and it is 1:33. We are also being joined by Senator Gardner. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you to our recording secretary and LI operator Carrie and Leah. Really appreciate it. Today we have three items on the agenda. We have Senate Bill 108, introduced by Senator Giesel. She's here with her staff, Jane Conway. This deals with medical care and licensing in the medical board. Then we will have Senate Bill 160. This is broadband internet, and it has been introduced by Senator Begich. And then Representative Ortiz has a bill before us today, House Bill 18. So we will go ahead and begin with our first item. I'd like to welcome Senator Giesel to the committee and provide you an opportunity to share with the committee the reason for the bill, and any questions that we have, we'll hopefully get those answered. And then it looks like we have a few people online to assist us with this bill. So welcome.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committees. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N. The bill before you today is Senate Bill 108. This was brought to me by request from the State Medical Board. The bill does two things. Number one, it streamlines physician licensing. And secondly, it addresses an issue related to the assistance that they have in their office. So first of all, Madam Chair, the State Medical Board has requested the authority to write regulations to delegate some additional duties to their executive administrator. They've had an executive administrator for many, many years, and this bill would allow that executive administrator to review applications and actually grant licenses if all the requirements are met. So when a license is submitted to the Board of Medicine, it's reviewed by a licensing examiner. That's staff to the board. The examiner looks to make sure all the pieces are there. Criminal background check, credentials, things like that. If the license is complete and, air quotes, clean, in other words, no criminal background flags or anything like that, then the license examiner would pass that on to the executive administrator, who would confirm that the credentials are all in place. Then that executive administrator would be authorized by the board to actually issue that license. The bill also provides that the executive administrator could issue a temporary license, again, if all the requirements and the application is complete. Granting certification is another type of a licensing recognition that she would be able to do. And the board would be able to spell out the prohibitions to this delegated authority. Madam Chair, a question is often asked, well, does anybody else do this? Yes, there are many other boards, even in our state, that use this procedure to expedite routine license issuance and temporary license issuance. The board also asked that there be provision for another person designated by the board, so perhaps another board member, who could also help that executive administrator in the issuance of a temporary license. And you see that in sections 10 and 11, and it outlines when this could happen. So that's the first issue, Madam Chair. Now the question is this really needed? I mean, is there a backlog? Are physicians having to wait for licenses? Actually, it is. There is somewhat of a backlog. Right now, if an application is complete, the information I've been given from the Division of Licensing is that licenses are typically issued within 2 months. Now, only about 5% of the applications are complete when they're submitted. So physician applicants apparently aren't finishing their applications thoroughly. But in any case, right now there's a backlog of about 290 applications. I know there are people here from the division who will be happy to go into depth with you on that information. Telemedicine is the piece that has increased the number of applicants that the board is receiving. As you may remember, when we authorized telemedicine, we said that any physician providing care through telemedicine would also have to be licensed in the state. And so they're getting many applications. The second piece of the bill refers to the issue of who assists a physician in their offices. In the old days, Madam Chair, physicians hired registered nurses or licensed practical nurses to assist them in their offices. These are both folks who are licensed people. But then in the 90s, physicians looked to less expensive folks to help them with routine medical tasks. So right now when you go to a physician's office, likely, of course, the receptionist checks you in, and then a very nice young person, male or female, invites you to come back to the examination room. That person will take your blood pressure, your temperature, will ask you questions about your symptoms, what medications you're on, and enter them into the computer system for the physician. These folks are medical assistants. This is a category of assisting people who assist a physician that were created by the medical profession. In the beginning, those folks were trained on the job, so OJT training. Nowadays, you probably see ads, for example, from community colleges on TV saying, we offer training programs for medical assistants. So now there actually is training programs for those folks. But in any case, it's the referral or the delegation by the physician to these medical assistants that requires statutory change. Up until now, physicians have not had the authority to delegate those medical tasks, even though they're routine, taking a blood pressure, maybe giving your child a vaccination. They didn't have the authority to delegate that task. And so there's actually been apparently some of the malpractice insurers have notified the physicians that you need to change your state laws so that you can delegate these things. So the bill does that. It, in Section 3, you will see that it authorizes delegation to an unlicensed person. It also has a prohibition in there related to any activity related to pain management or opioids. So these are folks that are not licensed. They would not be authorized to look into the prescription drug monitoring database to assist the physician in knowing whether he or she could prescribe opioids for that patient. These are just simple medical assistants doing routine medical tasks. It adds the unlicensed person to Section 6, where it talks about delegating those routine medical duties, and it comes under the heading of license to practice medicine, podiatry, or osteopathy. So that's simply the statute where it would go, so that these folks would not be accused of practicing medicine, podiatry, or osteopathy because they were delegated these activities. And then in Section 13, you see that they come under criminal law, under Title 12, which is criminal procedure, as folks that are medical professionals. So that's one category of the assistants that work for a physician, unlicensed medical assistants. The medical board then asked that we provide for them a licensed medical assistant. This request came from pain doctors who need an assistive person in their office that can look into the PDMP for them. And you may remember when we crafted that opioid bill, we said you must be licensed to look into the database. So, with no licensed people in their office, it means the physician has to stop between patients, go look up the patient they're about to see, is it appropriate for me to prescribe opioids? It takes a lot of time out of their day. So the solution, we have community colleges that have training programs for certified medical assistants. In addition, there are national examinations which certify these folks. So they can go to, for example, Charter College. I'm just naming one that advertises. Take the education course and then take the national exam, become certified, and then apply to the board, state medical board, for certification as a certified medical assistant. The state of Washington is one example of the many states that have this procedure and recognize certified medical assistants. And in the bill, in Section 4, you see it, certification is called out. The criteria for that, the things that the person would have to do, will be spelled out in regulation by the board. Title 5 identifies the title and protects the title so that someone can't just say, well, I'm a certified medical assistant. The title is protected. And in Section 12, there is a penalty for someone practicing as a CMA without a license. There is an urgent need for this bill. State Medical Board understands that, first of all, they need to become much more expeditious in licensing. They also need that delegation authority to unlicensed medical assistants to do those routine procedures in their offices so that their malpractice insurance will say, okay, you're good now, you're covered by state law. And last of all, they need those certified medical assistants who can do more complex assistive procedures for them. The bill is supported by the State Medical Board and the Department of Commerce, Division of Professional Licensing, also supports the bill. We have received no opposition to it. And there are folks here from the division who are happy to give you very credible information. I think there's also a pain clinic online that might be interested in speaking to you as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Giesel. I did want to also mention for those listening online that Senator Meyer has been here essentially since the beginning of the committee. So with that, are there questions of committee members, Senator Gardner? No?
Thank you.
Senator Machicki?
Two questions. The first is about Section 3. Do you have any concerns in not defining routine medical duties? I understand that we have a medical board, and I certainly trust the leadership of Dr. Humphreys, but just wondering if, is it typical that we give them the latitude to define those duties themselves?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes, indeed it is very logical. Very similar authority is given to the Board of Nursing, who also delegates to unlicensed assistive personnel. Mm-hmm. So the board knows exactly what those routine medical duties would be that would be appropriate for an unlicensed person.
Okay, and I follow up.
Senator Machicki?
Do we not have a method or in statute, is it not? Do we not allow a temporary permit for an applicant who meets the qualification requirements?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, we do indeed. This bill simply allows the executive administrator or someone designated by the board to issue that temporary license.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Machicki,
so a designated board member is now currently authorized. You're adding an executive secretary or a board designee to temporarily permit an applicant.
You are correct.
Okay.
Executive administrator.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that was partially answered. Just questioning the executive administrator, who chooses that person, I assume it's the medical doctor, so somebody they have a great deal of trust in. It sort of sounds a little loose to say, and another person. The other person that they're choosing, I guess, are there any qualifications required? Can it be anybody? You did mention that it might be a doctor who's on the board, but I just want to make sure that it's going to a person who's qualified to do the job.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, absolutely. First of all, the executive administrator is hired by the Board of Medicine in collaboration with the Division of Professional Licensing. It is generally, at least what I've participated in, a pretty rigorous process, and there are criteria for the individual that they hire. So the person is very credible. It is the board that wished to have that additional board member who could act if the executive administrator were absent.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe you could clarify that, because I'm reading on page 4. It just says, allow another person designated by the board. It doesn't really say another board member. Is that in the bill, that other person is, in fact, on the board and a medical person.
That's the section.
I'm looking for which page through the chair you are on, Senator Stevens.
Page 5.
We'll take a brief at ease. Our Commerce Committee has been called back to order.
Thank you for the question, Senator Stevens. Through the chair, this was language that was requested by the board. They may have been thinking, and I can't speak for them because I didn't ask the specific question, but they may have been thinking perhaps delegating this to the licensing examiner themselves, who also scrutinizes an application. But in any case, the Board of Medicine, our state medical board, is extremely careful about who they license, either with a full license or a temporary license. This pertains to a temporary permit, and I am confident in their judgment of who they would choose if they chose someone else.
Thank you, through the chair. We know that all medical doctors are godlike figures, and they cannot make any mistakes. I think I understand what you're saying. So it's not a willy-nilly appointment of anybody off the street. It's someone with some qualifications and background. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Stevens.
Maybe we'll hear from God in a moment, too.
I don't see that person signed up to speak, so. Any further questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, Senator Giesel and Jane. We do have a few individuals who have signed up off net, and I'd go ahead and open public testimony for Senate Bill 108. And the first person online is Dr. Danny Robinette, the Chief Medical Officer of the Foundation Health Partners. Dr. Robinette, please feel free to provide your testimony.
Okay, thank you very much for this opportunity. Testifying on behalf of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and the Tanana Valley Clinic around Senate Bill 108, while I recognize the admirable job the medical board has done, we have had periodic delays in getting physicians licensed. This has actually resulted on three occasions in the past 2 years where we've lost a physician candidate for a position to another position out of state because obviously they're wanting income, and waiting several months for a license has become an issue. I even have one surgeon on staff here who is originally from Fairbanks, went out to medical school in Seattle, did his surgical residency in Wisconsin and returned, and it was almost 8 months for his license to go through. So while many times they go through timely, there are certainly evidences of delays. So we would advocate strongly for anything that could expedite the process for a clean candidate without a blemish. We certainly support and agree that it's critical to maintain the integrity and rigor of the licensing process. We want to screen these candidates very carefully, and certainly candidates with issues should receive closer scrutiny and take more time. But we would really strive to ask to streamline the process for a clean candidate with no blemishes on their record so that we aren't losing good physicians from Alaska to other states for that reason. And I would be happy to entertain any questions from the committee.
Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Doctor. Mining and a horrible situation where people are held up for several months with a need help, jobs. Is there any legitimate reason though to hold up a application for 8 months? Are there issues that might require more time? 8 months seems like a long time, but are there any issues out there that you think might require 8 months? Can you justify that at all?
I could justify that in some cases. I would tell you in this particular individuals, no, I can't justify that. But if I have a candidate, just like for licensing, when we screen someone for privileging in our hospital, you know, there are concerns, red flags, not frequent malpractice cases. The physician is moving frequently from one place to another. Things like that raise red flags, and then it bears taking some time to fully investigate why the physician left. Did they leave because, well, we just got tired and wanted to go somewhere else? Or did they leave because there were issues, and then they went somewhere else and there were issues? And to do that can take quite a bit of time. It requires making phone calls and sending letters to all the facilities. 8 months is a long time. Typically can be done sooner than that, but just as an extreme example, if you have someone with blemishes and issues, we certainly want to be sure we've thoroughly vetted all those before we make a decision to grant a license or to have them treat patients in our facility.
Well, thank you, Dr. Robinette. So your belief is that this would speed up the process without any danger of approving someone who shouldn't be approved, but it also gives the board the time to spend as much time as they need if there are concerns and red flags.
I agree with that because I think it's fairly clearly defined in the statute and the regulation what are the things that constitute what we call essentially a clean application. And given that and that the board is defining that themselves, I think, and then delegating approval of a clean application, I think that's correct. And we don't want to put a timeline that rushes them on one that may not be a clean application.
Thank you, Doctor.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Doctor. I read the, I don't know if you reviewed the Legislative Research Services document that talks about some of that. One of the questions is the average processing time for a medical license is 8 to 12 weeks, and then the answer said that it's approximately 12 to 14 weeks. In the past year, that time frame has been extended to 16 to 18. And the follow-up question says, when applications take longer than 12 weeks, and the answer is completed applications never take this long. The question, which sort of contradicts the first answer, but the question I have is it looks like a temporary permit requirements are the same as a permit requirements. So how much time can a temporary permit issuance save over? And what would be the reason if they have to satisfy the requirements anyway? What could be missing that would be saving time while they were awaiting a result, a report, or something?
I would defer the full answer of that to the board, to the medical board itself, because I don't know all of the details of why they would issue a temporary or permanent. Typically, we would issue temporary privileges in our hospital to someone for exigent patient care reasons, and typically, again, it would be a clean application. If they want, you know, it may be that they prefer to approve a temporary license pending full board review of the application and one that they think is clean or has only a minimal problem, but I defer the full answer to that to the board.
Wait, Madam Chair, I just wonder if Mr. Or Dr. Humphreys is online. Is there someone from the board?
I do not see anyone from the board online, but we will try to get that question addressed before the end of the hearing today. Thank you, Dr. Robinette. Next, we have Kira Boyd, who's calling in from Wasilla.
Good afternoon. My name is Kira Boyd, last name spelled B-O-Y-D, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Algon, Alaska's premier in pain and wellness clinics. Our clinics, both in Anchorage and Wasilla, offer regenerative medicine, interventional pain management, as well as dependency therapy, with a focus on opioid use disorders. We provided the clinical oversight to the Lazarus Project, a pilot study funded by the Matt Sue Health Foundation, which laid the foundation in Alaska for including the Bridge device in many opioid detox programs. We also host our own recovery group weekly, led by a licensed counselor. Most physicians are time poor, but especially here in Alaska and especially here at Algon, where as you can imagine, we regularly treat high-needs, high-touch patient population. Most clinics are faced with high overhead costs, But again, especially here in Alaska, and again, especially here at Algon, where specialty providers often require lucrative compensation packages to lure them to the Arctic, the conversations on how to address these problems are happening, and Algon's jumping in. Algon's founder, Dr. Tom Grissom, was presenting at an ACS-CAN policy forum when he met Senator Giesel. It was this conversation when Senator Giesel became aware of the oversight in HB 159 we are addressing today. HB 159 recognized that time-poor physicians would need delegates to assist them to meet the new and long-overdue Alaska state PDMP requirements. But in an effort to retain control over enforcement, HB 159 specifies that only a licensed professional under AS 08 could be a delegate. Medical assistants are not currently licensed under AS 08. Algon has a team of over 40 medical assistants, who with our providers create teams that take care of those high-needs, high-touch patients. But with HB 159 and the implementation of the PDMP, our care teams became dramatically less efficient overnight. Algon sought immediately to find a solution and reached out to Dr. Jay Butler, who advised that amending HB 159 would be a tedious and potentially futile effort. Getting creative, we started looking at other states that did license its medical assistants. So when we found ourselves talking with Senator Giesel, we were ready with model legislation to send to her staff, and now here we are giving supporting testimony to this distinguished committee. Not only does Algon fully support SB 108, we want this committee to know that the process works. This is exactly how legislation should come before you, and we're so proud and thankful of the team of problem solvers who worked to get us here. The State Medical Board expressed concerns over cost and resources to get medical assistance licensed, but the cost and resources to work around the HB 159 oversight is unavoidable. Either we can create an efficient and simple system for licensing, or we can require clinics to hire more nurses, less medical assistants, and pass that cost on to our already overburdened healthcare consumers. SB 108 is the solution that Alaska needs now. Thank you.
Any questions of Kira Boyd?
Thank you for testifying. Oh, Senator Stevens has a question for you.
Thank you, Ms. Boyd. So you have 40 medical assistants unlicensed. How many of those then would become medical assistants? Certified medical assistants.
Well, let me clarify. Not all of our medical assistants are unlicensed. There are a number of them that are, but we also have quite a few nationally certified medical assistants. In a perfect world, all of our medical assistants would become certified.
I see. So, Madam Chair, through the Chair, so you already have certified medical assistants. I thought this was a new entry.
No, I mean, we do have some certified medical assistants, but not all of them are. And so the ones that are not currently able to look into the PDMP and assist their providers in that regard.
I see. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and take a brief at ease. Did you want to clarify? Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. I'd like to continue with the public testimony and calling in from the Alaska Academy of Physician Assistants in Anchorage is Brian Farthing. Brian, if you could provide your testimony, please.
Hi, I'm Brian Farthing. I'm a PA and I'm the current president of the AKA PA. And I just want to appreciate the time getting to speak and the work that's been done on Senate Bill 108. Our concern from the PA community is when there's physicians and DOs and psychiatrists listed in some of the bill that the PAs or physician assistants aren't always included, specifically looking at the granting temporary licenses. We wanted to address this as a concern, if there's any specific reason, in that when looking at the ability for delegating to medical assistants that physician assistants were included throughout the bill, so that there's not concern in the future, as has happened in the past with other bills that exclude physician assistants as far as the regular duties, so that in the future that that's not becoming an issue for the physician assistants to be able to be included as a member of the healthcare team.
Senator Stevens, any further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Wendy Smith, a physician assistant here in Juneau. Wendy? Wendy, are you calling in online or are you here in the room? She's obviously changed her mind. I'd next like to invite Fred Parody, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and also Janie McCullough, the Director of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing. Welcome, and I see you signed up for questions, so if there's any questions that you've heard that you'd like to respond to, that'd be great. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Parody. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. One of our five operating divisions is Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, an area of significant focus for us as a leadership team. I want to begin today by expressing my deep appreciation to Senator Giesel for her longstanding commitment to these topics, as well as her professional insight into the subject that's before us. We've worked with her over the years from her role as LBNA and on this topic. I want to step back just to a description of how we got to where we are today as a department. The workload of the medical board has increased dramatically primarily due to telemedicine legislation. In 2015, the backlog reached an average of 6 months. Obviously, outliers from that can go longer. In application processing time, due to the volume of applications received, we had telemedicine companies coming in that might be licensing 100 docs in a group. As many of you know from your work in political life and public life, I'm fielding complaints from applicants, and medical facilities can be time-consuming. So Alaska's demand for healthcare professionals has only increased since 2015. In fact, the division processed 22% more medical licenses and 31% more nursing licenses last year than the year before, and we've already received more in this fiscal year to date than we did in the previous year in 12 months. Through the budget process and recent legislation, we have been able to devote more staff to these programs. We've added two PCNs. Those are, of course, paid by licensing fees. And we went through a triage process where we worked to reduce that backlog. But we also, more strategically or more importantly, we initiated a strategic planning initiative streamlining the application process for healthcare professions, medical and nursing, was identified as our highest priority. And I want to share with you today the results of the work by that hardworking team. That process, the strategic planning process, included a comprehensive examination of our application process by a team of our examiners that are doing this work every day. It wasn't managers or commissioners. It was the team on the front lines of fielding those phone calls and dealing with those. I want to just use this as a visual aid. This was our quarterly report. But we went through a process to identify what we called RUBS, which are just roadblocks or barriers, obstacles, and we identified 27 RUBS. That's half of them. And the next flow sheet is the other half of them. And when you hit that spreadsheet, that process flow diagram, you'll see things that you would expect. We require, speaking perhaps directly to the 8 months case that was offered. We require applicants send certified and true copies of their diploma and all certificates. The question we asked ourselves was, do we need certified and true copies when we already require verifications? Is there a way to streamline those requirements? Specifically germane to this bill, Rub 17 was every single application needs to be approved by the executive administrator. And considering the amount of applications we move forward, waiting for approval can be time-consuming, both at the executive director and at the board level. The board might not meet every month. It can take up to 3 months for the board to meet. The board needs to review every single file. This is Rub 22, even those that do not have any discrepancies. And what this bill allows you to do is to delegate that authority. And in answer to the delegation question, my understanding of the reason the statutory proposed language says or other person designated by the board is it could be another board member or it could be the director of CBPL or the deputy director. It depends on what's caused the absence, but it is an active delegation of that authority. It's not random or...
Madam Chair, could we ask the definition of the CBPL?
CBPL, Corporations Business and Professional Licensing. So it's the executive director supervisor.
Thank you, and Deputy Commissioner, if you don't mind providing a copy of that material to my committee aide, which is the best way to get materials distributed to the members. Thank you.
I would be very happy to. I just want to note I saw it in my file as I prepared to come over here and was just using it as a visual aid. But the strategic planning process then continued as we evaluated the cause of each problem, determine whether it served a public safety need or whether the process was simply outdated or even obsolete or could be just simplified. So in response to those 27 RUBS, we initiated a three-prong approach to implementing solutions that would streamline this licensure process. The first was, and you've heard testimony to this effect, we did small changes through the just through board regulations, through reg projects. And those are already underway. The medical board specifically proactively scrubbed their regulations. They have a reg project that will follow this bill. But an example from that arena in terms of a reg change was we had a requirement that a notary stamp be on the photograph of that accompanies the application. Ostensibly, that's to verify that the person in the picture is the person in the application. But actually, first of all, notaries are taught not to put their stamp onto such a place. And secondly, the notary is just attesting that the person standing in front of them is the person in the picture. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're the person with the applicant. It doesn't add a public safety value. But we're trying to scrub those granular details that slow things down. The second project, second prong of our implementation strategy, and this is the one that's fun to report to you today on, is improvements in our IT platform, improvements in our technology. Currently, licensees are able to submit online applications to renew existing licenses. You heard testimony today that roughly only 5% of the applicants that we receive are good to go as they come in the door. So we've done two things with this new IT approach. One is to make it like your PFD. You can't advance past the question until you've answered the question. And the second, this is an inspiration from our deputy director, Sarah Chambers, who's familiar to many of you. She was watching TV one night, and there was a pizza tracker for Domino's where you could track the progress of your pizza. And what she thought was, why can't we have a license tracker so that our applicants can see where they're at and what a holdup might be? Both those features are being added to our IT enhancement as part of this project, and we anticipate rollout next month. It's been an arduous process to get here. We've been at this for over a year. And finally, the last requirement of the streamlining project is a change in statutes that would improve license processing times while still ensuring public safety. The minor changes in this bill will allow the medical board to grant additional authority to the executive administrator to issue licenses that meet the strictest guidelines, don't have a problem, and allow further delegation to supervisors to expedite and issue temporary licenses. Also, as you heard, this closes the loop with our PDM program by certifying our medical assistants so that they are then eligible to provide those services to their doctor in the PDMP program. So your support of this bill is the next step in ensuring that Alaska's healthcare facilities are able to keep their doors open and much needed positions are filled in a timely manner. And I want to close by noting that we're not perfect, but we are attentive and focused on these issues. When the Fairbanks facility can't get a doctor in the door, the call comes to us, and it does receive our full attention. For nurses also, there's little granular details. We had a nurse, this is a personal experience of mine, if I can divert and relate, but we had a nurse who, through her error, allowed her license to lapse. Well, once your license has lapsed, you're not renewing, you're reapplying. And it's amazing the hoops that you have to jump through. I will say that our service level is substantial. I climbed the food chain in California trying to assist her, kept getting recordings. I finally went into their commissioner's office and got a live person. She took a companion fare, flew to Sacramento, walked into their office with cash because they won't accept Visa, to get her transcript certified so she could bring it back to us and we could, in fact, proceed. There are, we've been hard at work on those granular details where we can better serve the public, and ultimately better serving these professionals better serves Alaska citizens.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Are there questions? Senator Michigi, do you feel like you had your question answered, or would you like Ms. McAuliffe to respond?
Well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That actually is not a question that he answered on the, I guess, first of all, why is there a temporary permit? And if it satisfies the requirements of the other permits, why is it still temporary?
You want to take it?
Yeah, you.
No, you.
Oh. Yeah.
No.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Janie McCullough. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And the short answer for a temporary license, currently as it is now, the executive administrator can approve a temporary license pending the full board's review at their next meeting. So it's a way of getting people to work as fast as we can, and then the formal full license is issued after the board has approved each and every license at their next meeting.
Senator Michigi.
So what I'm getting to is the reality of it is it there's no less of a requirement for a temporary permit as there is for a full license, other than the board's action.
For the record, Senator Michigi, sorry, through the chair, there is very little, and I don't know the nuance, but it's very close to having a full license approved. I don't think that, other than the final board approval, you have to meet the same criteria for a temporary license as you do a full license.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Deputy Commissioner, I was intrigued by a process to follow the application through the department, and I'm curious if this is something that you've shared with other departments. I was thinking the teacher certification process and then also the permitting process that is somewhat like a Rube Goldberg exercise for people in the public. You know, could they actually follow their application? I just find that a very creative solution, and I was hoping you would share that with other departments.
Senator, Madam Chairman, with respect, I want to make sure it operates first, and then, of course, that's a great idea. And also, we have 43 license groups in this department, so we pick the healthcare professions as our starting point because they're so essential, but we also want to roll it out across our platform. So your suggestion is well taken and a good idea, and I would be happy to talk to PTPC and others once we succeed.
Great, thank you. Is there anyone else in Juneau that would like to testify on Senate Bill 108? Hey, is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is now closed on Senate Bill 108. And I will look to the will of the committee. Comments? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 108, version U, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to moving Senate Bill 108 from committee? Okay, seeing none, so moved, and we'll take a brief at ease. Back to order. And next we have the sponsor of Senate Bill number 160, Senator Begich, and your staff, Sydney Linneman. Welcome, and please feel free to introduce your bill, and we'll have questions for you, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name, as you mentioned, for the record, is Tom Begich. I'm the state senator for District J, and with me is my chief of staff, Dr. Sydney Linneman. SB 160 is a bill relating to net neutrality, and I want to first commend the committee for passage of SGR 12, which is relating to a similar topic that you passed out of committee last week. What SB 160 does is move this as out of not just in the federal scheme, but also to the local level. And just for way of introduction, net neutrality means that the company which provides you access to the Internet does not get to decide what you do on the Internet. Under net neutrality, those companies cannot block content. They cannot throttle content. There's no such thing as prioritization unless it's reasonable for network management purposes. Net neutrality is essential to protecting free speech, religious freedom, the marketplace of ideas, the free market, and as my staff puts it, apple pie. SB 160 would require ISPs, internet service providers, who provide broadband internet to Alaskans to engage in the practice of net neutrality. The bill would make sure all data on the internet is treated equally. It would protect small businesses from uncompetitive practices and guarantee unrestricted internet access for all internet users. Without net neutrality, ISPs may legally speed up certain sites and have been shown to do so in the past, slow down others, which they have been shown to do so in the past, block sites altogether, and require certain users to pay more for internet fast lanes. The elimination of net neutrality gives ISPs the power to determine what websites consumers could visit and what content website creators could share. Allowing ISPs to discriminate based on content undermines the free and open internet, and in my opinion is not just un-Alaskan but un-American. Broadband, like the electrical grid, should be neutral to the content it powers. We would not allow a situation where an electric company could decide which brand of microwave you use or whether you could have a certain brand of toaster or another. Likewise, we wouldn't wish that for the internet and what kind of content would be provided for us by the internet. If I may read for a moment, Madam Chair.
Of course.
This is from a letter, and I want to read you this before I tell you who it's from. Net neutrality policies helped create the most free and fair marketplace in history, allowing consumers to choose the winners and losers in a competitive marketplace. This resulted in the best ideas, products, and services rising to the top. The new regulations will leave consumers with less choice and our economy with less innovation and competition. Without equality of access, such innovation would be diminished at best or perhaps even begin to move to competing countries in the world economy. The new FCC regulations set the cable and phone companies up to become the equivalent of the mafia to the internet. Today, consumers dictate the evolution of the internet. Under the new regulations, cable and phone companies will be making the decisions, and their decisions will not be made based on quality, but rather on who pays the most protection money to be protected from the competition of a truly free marketplace. Those are excerpts from Fast Facts for Conservatives on Net Neutrality produced by the Christian Coalition. Because net neutrality affects an individual, whether they are a liberal or a conservative, a Democrat or a Republican, a Christian or a non-believer. It affects us all. That's why this issue is so important. There is a question that's been brought up of what we call preemption legally. Does the bill preempt the federal government's right to be the supreme law of the land, as it is a state bill? Well, the FCC's order speaks to that explicitly, saying that its ruling preempts, quote, state or local measures that would effectively impose rules or requirements that we have repealed or decided to refrain from imposing. In this body, however, we have over and over again questioned the federal government's authority to dictate to us. We do so all the time. I have here from the Natural Resources Committee a list of all the different issues we are currently undergoing right now where we're disputing the role of the federal government in dictating what happens in the state of Alaska. I say that because it's important for us to remember that in each of these instances, whether it was on navigable rivers, or coastlines, or hunting and fishing rights, we always sought to protect the rights of Alaskans first. And then we let the courts decide when an issue is ambiguous. And it is unclear in this issue whether it is or isn't ambiguous yet. The states of Washington, Montana, and other states are, in fact, over 30 states are now either considering similar legislation or have already introduced such legislation. We modeled this on those bills precisely because we need to send a message to Washington, D.C., that this is the appropriate way to deal with net neutrality. And quite frankly, it should be the federal government that decides this. We had a moment in our office where we spoke with one of our own ISPs here in Alaska, internet providers, and we agreed that this should be decided legislatively at the federal level. But we also believe in our office, and I think the legislature has an interest in this, that we need to send the message to our state, federal delegation, as we did with the resolution, but also with our own action, that we're willing to protect our people. We have to send that message. The internet's always been a platform for free speech. and for free enterprise. It should not be in the hands of ISPs to pick our winners and losers. As the letter said from the Christian Coalition, consumers should be making that choice. I believe that. I believe that you believe that as well. The free market of ideas is a vital part of what has made the Internet great and has led to dramatic economic growth in this country, in part because of the protections provided to it during its infancy. Labor and Commerce is the Senate's Committee on the Economy and on Innovation. This is precisely where we need to speak with the strongest voice on all those issues which would threaten that economy or innovation. I'm grateful that you've taken the time to hear about this bill. I'm here to answer questions when I can. I also have Dr. Linneman to answer questions. I do have a subcommittee on DEC at 2:30, but I'll stay for as long as I possibly can. Thank you for your
time. Thank you, Senator Begich. Are there questions of committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who could be opposed to this?
You going to cry?
No, I'm going to sneeze.
Well, that's not a question I'm ready to answer, Senator through the chair, Senator Stevens. I can't imagine reasonable people would be opposed to it. I was gratified by my conversations with the ISP here in state in that their interests in protecting the rights of consumers to have access to a free and unfettered Internet. And I would add, if we were the only state that had net neutrality, if we were the only state and every other state got rid of it, that would actually provide a competitive advantage for our ISP because they would have more to offer than others that might be restricting content. So I would suspect maybe large companies. The record shows that in the past, Comcast, the second largest Internet provider in the country, did in fact take advantage of weaker rules at the time to restrict content, to limit content, to slow down content for providers. You may recall just a few years back the Netflix debate. Netflix was negotiating for how its movies would be delivered, and it literally was forced into a position of having to compromise and to negotiate because the speed of its provision of its movies was questioned. What the Internet was in 2005 and what it is today is dramatically different. Today, the Internet is not like making a phone call. It's we do movies and videos and all kinds of content. It is critical not just to what our students need to know in schools here in the state of Alaska, but what our individuals and consumers need if they want to have quick access to the marketplace. So really, the record seems to show that only very large ISPs would oppose this move.
Thank you. I do have a question. On page 1, lines 7 through 9, it talks about that the utility that provides broadband Internet access services in the state shall publicly disclose accurate information regarding the network management practices, performance, and commercial terms of the utility's broadband Internet access service in a manner sufficient for, and then it provides basically, I think, for a bunch of transparency-related items. Is this something that's already being publicly disclosed? And what do we mean when we say accurate information regarding and then these items?
I will. Do you want to try to answer that?
Sure.
Sydney? I could answer it too, but she's going to be able to do so.
I can make an effort to answer that question, and then we're also lucky enough to have the legal and policy director from the ACLU, for the record, Sydney Linneman, staff to Tom Begich. We also are lucky enough to have the legal and director of the ACLU here, who is much more of a policy expert on this issue. The FCC does require this first Section A that you're referring to. The FCC does require that Internet service providers make these public. They're not currently required to be published by our state consumer protection board, and the details of that I'm unsure on, and so we'll defer to the ACLU, our invited testimony.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Begich, you had mentioned earlier that there are numerous other states that are contemplating statutory changes similar to this. Could you provide to the committee a list of those states? And then my question is,
you know, bills are always drafted in a variety of different ways, whether they come, you know, from other states or drafted just by a conversation with Ledge Legal. Is this, could you just let me know who did draft this? Is this actually model legislation taken directly from another source? Was it our Ledge Legal? Was it, you know, was it, who was it that actually drafted it?
Superb question, Madam Chair. Thank you very much again, Tom Begich, for the record. It was drafted by our Ledge Legal, and it was based on the Washington state law. It was obviously modified to fit our statutes in that process by Ledge Legal. And the answer to the first question, which was, can we get you that list? Of course we can. And we had a list of around 20 and have since discovered while pending this hearing that it's actually over 30 that are either pending or proposing legislation now. So I'll make sure you get that list.
Thank you. And then on page 3, it talks on lines 8 and 9, which is section 2, it talks about the violations. It says that, I mean, obviously there would have to be some sort of enforcement, and I'm wondering if you could talk to the committee about what the ramifications would be if a company didn't publicly disclose accurate information. Or do we know the answer to that?
Well, they'd face being taken to court by the Consumer Protection Bureau. That's essentially the remedy that's here. My guess is that if we pass this law, and this is obviously my educated guess, yeah, would be there wouldn't be an Internet provider that would want to violate this law because you don't want to be taken to the Consumer Protection Bureau. So,
okay. Yeah. And then I have a final question before we go to Senator Meyer. So we did pass a resolution recently. Could you talk to us briefly about the difference between the legislature communicating through a resolution versus actual statutory changes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good question. I would be glad to. First off, in the resolution, what we're doing is we're instructing our Senate delegation, congressional delegation, to essentially there's a time period within which you can reject a federal regulation. That's both you have a process where you can actually, by a vote of the Senate and by a vote of the House, actually reject regulations provided by the federal government. We're still within that window. We have instructed in that, if that were to pass, that would instruct our delegation to vote no, and that would, frankly, make this bill moot if that were to actually happen, because we would then be back under net neutrality rules, and this the need for the bill and the legislation would then, at that point, go away. That window is rapidly approaching. I can't tell you the exact date. You can hold on that. Before we go to the exact date of where that is, the second question you asked was related to the difference. The other thing that this bill provides is it's a backup plan. I always like to have a plan B. As Senator Gardner knows, whenever we have conversations, there always needs to be a plan B. This plan B also sets out, by mirroring other states, we're basically setting a template around the country, whether it's a state in the south, a state in the north, a state in the east, a state in the west, of what we think net neutrality ought to look like. And the fact that almost all of these bills that look relatively similar reinforces that message at the federal level. And remember that what both the Internet provider here and I want is fundamentally federal law passed at some point. And oftentimes the states can lead by proposing the kind of law that we think ought to be adopted at the federal level. So I think this sets a model and a template for that kind of law.
Thank you.
And to answer the question a little bit further.
For the record, Cindy Litteman. The Congressional Review Act allows Congress to reject new regulations within 60 days of publication in the Federal Register. And as far as I know, as of today, the FCC has not yet published that regulation in the Federal Register, but has notified Congress that they will likely do so very shortly.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Begich, I think you might have answered my question, but my question was, shouldn't we have this done at the federal level? Because if each state does something different, then some of your larger Internet carriers might just go to those states where they have the largest population, and Alaska may actually be adversely impacted, even though your intent is not.
To the chair, Senator Meyer, I think I may have addressed the question first. In a way, if we pass this law, it actually could improve our providers, GCI, ACS. It could actually improve their ability to compete should an outside competitor come in that isn't bound by net neutrality, because that competitor might not have as many offerings or might have various speeds. So our operators would be required to provide all offerings would be open to content. So in the first instance, I think it actually might enhance competition. Secondarily, as I mentioned, this actually helps us set a template. There are times, and I'm sure you agree, given that list that I know you've been a party to as well, of all these actions, there are times when the federal government simply doesn't get it, and they don't follow, they don't lead. And so sometimes the states have to lead and set the example. We've done this in numerous other issues where this state or other states has set the example, whether it's everything from whether you like them or not, the marijuana legislation issues, whether it's in terms of how we deal with marriage issues, or whether it's in how we deal with federal land issues. All of these very issues are often driven by actions at the state level. We have a chance to be a leader in this process, and I think we should.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any further questions, Senator Stevens?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Begich, could you shed any light on the FCC decision, what they thought they were accomplishing, the members, and I don't need a biography, but what their background is and what they thought they were trying, what they were trying to do and what they accomplished?
Well, it's an interesting issue. So back when the Internet was in its, if you will, its infancy, it really was more like a telephone call, so it was regulated under what's called Title I of the FCC Act. So basically what Title I did is it regulates just that communication process. It's a fairly light touch, is what they how they refer to it, light touch regulatory spectrum. Title II was used for information resources and information services, so if that's stuff that you might store or hold on to or keep and download, those kinds of things. Then those were governed under FCC's Title II regulation. What we saw was a series of actions take place while the Internet was developing, some of which I've described to you. The Comcast one in particular sticks out in my mind, but there are a number of others. I have some I could read to you if you wish, but a number of different actions that led the FCC to realize that they needed to regulate, the first attempt to regulate more fully under Title I, which they did back in 2010. What happened was that was taken to court in the federal district court in D.C. The judge at the time rejected the attempts to further regulate under Title I the Internet. So in 2015, that happened in 2014. In 2015, the FCC moved the regulation, if you will, of the Internet into Title II. That was once again challenged by the same folks before the same judge, and this time the judge said, fine, this is exactly how you need to be regulating this industry to ensure neutrality of content, because this is the more appropriate place to do it. In November of 2017, indication was that there was going to be a change. There were a series of actions taken. You've heard the stories of millions of both pro and con statements, many of which were falsified on both sides coming before the FCC, bots, other kinds of bombing of this testimony. And even our own governor wrote saying this is highly unusual, and we really would ask you to not make a decision until we've had a chance to fully examine this issue. But the chairman of the FCC chose not to do that and chose to move forward, and that happened, of course, in, I believe it was late December, early January, late December of 2017. So that's kind of the history of how it went from Title II, then repealed from Title II, so now it falls back under the light touch Title I, which you already know from past experience was not a way of protecting net neutrality.
And Madam Chair, what I was getting at is that the number of members in the FCC and what the vote was.
I think the vote was... I don't want to speculate a guess, but it was a majority vote, and it was by one vote. I know that. So,
It was 4-3.
Was it 4-3, or 3-2?
But we can be corrected if there needs to be a correction.
Might have been 3-2, but 4-3, 3-2. But it was by one vote.
Thank you,
Senator Gardner. All right. Well, thank you very much. If you could get that information to my committee aide, Natasha, and.
We'll take care of it. And thank you very much for your time. I'm afraid I don't want to leave before you've addressed my bill, but I think Senator Von Imhoff might not be happy if I'm too late.
Free to leave. Hey, I'll go ahead and open public testimony on Senate Bill 160. First, I'll call on Jeannie Pierce calling in from Kasilov. Jeannie, if you could provide your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Jeannie Pierce. I'm from Kosilos, and I'm representing myself and my husband. But I'd like to, Senator Stevens, I believe he asked a question, who doesn't like net neutrality? Try Sinclair Broadcasting, the group. On FTV Live, they published in full, says that the Sinclair PAC supports candidates for Congress who can influence the future of broadcasting. So there you go. But, okay, my testimony, net neutrality, we are in support of SB 160. Improvement, welcome. Net neutrality is about, do we trust corporations and free markets to continue to act in the best interest to ensure consumers' best interest to the true internet freedom and neutrality as we have done for decades, or trust government entities, primarily the FCC, to take over and act in our best interest. No, most Americans don't trust government, period. Government tends to change, to bend away from freedoms and towards control in the long run. It's about anti-corporate monopoly and, yes, profiteering. This is a threat to our free and open internet. To roll back net neutrality, regulate protections would allow internet services providers to, say, create preferential treatment of data speeds for certain users, including corporations linked across the network, open doors to paid fast lanes for some services and regulating others to slower speeds, increasing costs. How about it hurts smaller businesses? Net neutrality rule adopted in 2015 by the FCC basically required internet providers such as cable and wireless firms to treat all, I say all, equally. Reason was to prevent providers like AT&T or Comcast from using their leverage, disadvantaging other internet firms. This is a politically unpopular deregulation when it was deregulated. We need to prevent the consolidation of too much power in too few hands. Net neutrality rules prohibited a single entity from owning commercial broadcast television stations that collectively reached more than 39% of a total household in the nation. FCC is acting to put the control of the media in the hands of ever few corporate giants. We used to have our ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, all of them, they were prohibitive. These journals were prohibitive from contributing to political parties, candidates, or causes. The prohibition was aimed at eliminating the perception of partisanship by journalists, given that tradition, standards of conduct that has existed for 40 to 50 years.
Jeannie, so do you mind wrapping up, please?
When we do away with this is newsrooms, news directors would be supporting companies' agenda, potentially raising doubts about impartiality and independence when reporting on issues such as city or state legislative debates about deregulation. It would cause people to ask whether they're being fair and balanced in their coverage. Do what's right for the Alaska citizens, not what's best for your political party's interest.
Thank you, Jeannie, for your testimony. Appreciate your patience and waiting. Next, I'd like to invite Don McNamara. I'm sorry, I probably got your last name wrong. From Homer, followed by Donna Ray, also from Homer.
Hi, my name's Don McNamara. I live in Homer. I'm a farmer, and I just want to tell you that I'm for a free and open internet, and I think the last lady was a great speaker, so ditto what she says.
Thank you very much. Donna?
Hi, my name's Donna Ray Faulkner, for the record. I'm from Homer, Alaska also, and I also support everything that Tom Begich just said to the committee, and I really appreciate this bill and hope that it passes very well. I support a free and open internet.
Thank you. And then here in the room, Tara Rich with ACLU.
Good afternoon, Chair Costello. For the record, my name is Tara Rich. I'm the Legal and Policy Director of the ACLU of Alaska, and I know I've been before you once before on this issue with HJR 12, so I'll try to keep my comments short and sweet, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I try to think of different analogies to think about the issue of net neutrality and the way that it doesn't seem to quite fit with what we have in terms of a regulatory environment for any other issue. But, for example, with telephone systems, it would really be shocking and abhorrent if a telephone company could detect who you were talking to on the other end of the line or the subjects that you were talking about on the other end of that line. Right now, technology is at such a state with the internet that that's actually possible. It's developed in such a way that internet companies are able to track what you look at and what you do on the internet. And if a telephone company was to, let's say, drop calls intentionally to block numbers from you being able to dial out, or to make connections choppy intentionally based on the subjects of your conversation or who you were calling, we would all be up in arms about that. And so net neutrality presents the identical situation simply based on who that telecom company doesn't like. And I know I've spoken to this issue before, but this has happened in the past. And one specific example I wanted to bring to the attention of this committee, which I think is more relevant in terms of the economic or market forces in the background that are playing a role in this. In 2007, Comcast throttled a company, a peer-to-peer sharing network. It's called BitTorrent. There were a number of them that were happening simultaneously. For anybody who was around college age at this time, you'll remember BitTorrent as being this way to download all kinds of free movies, but also very open content. Trade manuals, for example, or trade videos were often downloaded and shared through BitTorrent. And Comcast was seeing that this was invading into the business model of cable companies. And this actually started historically long before BitTorrent and long before the internet, when you had local and long distance. You had telephone companies who traditionally based their business model off of the wires and the infrastructure that you have around the state, and you would get a phone bill and you would see local calls and long distance calls. When voice over IP or internet threatened that business model, because now when we pick up the phone, those calls are run through the internet, they moved into the cable industry. And so Comcast sees its business model being threatened by video sharing largely. And that we've seen proliferate throughout the internet. You have Netflix, you have Hulu, you have Amazon Prime Video, and you have things like BitTorrent. It was specifically in the company's interest to sort of dial that back so that people became more reliant on Comcast services. So that's exactly what we're talking about in terms of market forces. But it's also a very critical free speech issue. So for us, it's pretty much impossible to get through life without being able to go on the internet, whether for work, education, as Senator Begich mentioned, telemedicine, even in this state. It's freedom of expression really isn't worth much when the fora where people are having those conversations are not themselves free. The one other issue I wanted to speak to while I was before you, which I haven't dealt with before, is preemption. So there have been some concerns presented about whether federal law preempts state law, meaning that state law does not actually technically take effect if the federal law says that you cannot act in this area. So there's not a consensus among attorneys about whether this actually is preempted. There are state efforts to protect net neutrality going around the country. So this, whether this is going to survive a court challenge is up to interpretation. There are arguments that, for example, if the FCC is saying that the current federal statute, doesn't allow them to regulate ISPs to the degree that they would be required to regulate them for net neutrality to take effect, it seems a bit problematic for them to also say that very statute prevents states from acting in that same measure. So given the lack of uniformity, we think that you should let the courts decide this issue rather than trying to preempt it legislatively. And I'm happy to, one last thing that I did want to mention. If you are interested in looking at what a world without net neutrality looks like, I would recommend looking at Portugal's internet plan, for example. You can pull up photographs of how people can choose to purchase certain internet plans based on what they want to choose for content. And it's quite a stark image. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you. So could you give us any insight into the court actions, what could happen? Is there a court case underway? Can we expect this to be decided tomorrow? Or?
There are several actions pending. There are 22 state attorneys general who have filed suit. That suit relates primarily with the process-based questions that happened before the FCC. So, for example, during public testimony, which we had heard about through Senator Begich, there were substantial questions about whether the public comment period was up to snuff, let's say, according to the Administrative Procedures Act. It also challenges whether the FCC would need to create a whole new regulatory scheme rather than simply just eliminating the prior regulatory scheme. So that lawsuit is out there. I know Mozilla has a lawsuit. The Free Press also have lawsuits that are pending. I believe that many of these are waiting for the law to actually take effect and to be published on the Federal Register before they'll be filed, but we understand they're contemplated.
So likely years and years.
Unless net neutrality is repealed, as Senator Begich said, whether through the Congressional Review Act or if enough state consensus is garnered that it becomes no longer politically feasible or economically feasible for companies to be able to violate net neutrality principles, then yes, I think we probably are destined for years-long court battles.
Senator Michiki.
So to me, this seems premature. I definitely support the resolution, and I support net neutrality. I think I get it. But it seems to me like if you think of the few votes that would have to move, that there's a fairly good probability that Congress supports net neutrality. Wouldn't you agree with that from what you're hearing and what you're seeing?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, if you're referring to what I think, if I understand you correctly, then yes. I think that actually SB 160 would go a long way in sort of encouraging that. I believe what you're referring to is the action by Congress through the Congressional Review Act to be able to undo this regulation, or this Chairman Pai's open internet order of December 2017, that what I understand is that there are 49 votes for. We would need one more in the Senate. I also understand that Senator Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan haven't exactly said how they intend to vote if this issue were to come before them. And so I think the time is more critical than ever for the Alaska state legislature to use its power to be able to push that ball along as much as we can. And I believe that SB 160 is a big part of that. It sends a much different message to send along a resolution than it is to actually change state law. So I think that would really show the congressional delegation how much Alaska is united on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michiki.
There are things I have to learn about this bill. It seems completely unenforceable, if I'm reading it correctly, on the services that are provided outside of state lines. That's my problem. I could be wrong. I often am. But it seems like it's bigger than what happens within state lines, and I just don't see. I mean, you're making a statement, but we have a resolution that would be doing the same thing. Is there really anything that we can do to ISPs in Alaska that may or may not have any control of their own of the effects of a loss of net neutrality in the lower 48?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, I don't believe you're wrong about that. I do believe that you're right with respect to the national companies. Certainly nothing that the Alaska legislature can do would regulate Comcast, for example, or companies that simply have no business up here. I do think that Alaska legislature does have the authority to regulate companies who do business in Alaska. That much is clear. But much of what we know about net neutrality is that with regard to how throttling or how blockage occurs, we may not be able to fully control that. In other words, it may be true that Comcast gets in a spat with Netflix, and I'm just using those company names arbitrarily. They have no sort of basis in reality, to my knowledge. But if there's a disagreement about a contract between Comcast and Netflix, that they could actually throttle or block the content in absence of net neutrality rules. And if Alaska's internet service providers like GCI or ACS are using Comcast's cables through what are called peering agreements from the source of whatever servers Netflix has to transmit video up here, even though an Alaskan would have absolutely no relationship with Comcast whatsoever directly, they would still be affected by that. I think what we rest on in terms of being able to make these state law changes and is to stand behind a united front. As Senator Begich mentioned, there are now 30 states who are either contemplating or introducing legislation on this, and if it is united, if the people are sort of standing up and saying that we care a lot about this issue, it could become as economically unfeasible for them to do that, or there's enough momentum there to push federal regulation.
Last question.
Senator Machicki.
It seems that the tracking, so I'll give you an example. I was, when we come down, we bring our whole family, and along with our family comes a very large Labrador Retriever. And I was looking up larger kennels for where we're renting, right? So I looked it up, went back to work. Pretty soon, ads for dog kennels popped up in everything that I did for the rest of the day until I cleared my cache. So does the ACLU consider that the fact that it's unconstitutional according to Alaska's law with our privacy clause? And is that something that concerns you? I mean, how much right do we have to push back as a state on those larger privacy issues?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, that's a fantastic question. It's something that we're scrutinizing very carefully. We're about to launch what's called the Alaska Privacy Project that's going to look directly at those issues. If you really want to scare yourself, and anybody who has a Google account, and I don't mean to attack Google, but if you happen to have one, if you go to google.com/timeline, you will get to see a map of everywhere that you've been and logged into not just your email, but simply logged into a web search. So it shows details about your activity that are utterly terrifying. And yes, I believe that there are certain implications with regard to privacy, and there are many ways to attack that. I think that there are also privacy implications with the manner in which net neutrality would be enforced through the privacy that bear direct relevance on the privacy clause of the Constitution, because you would have to know exactly what people are accessing in order to be able to block or throttle it.
Any further questions? You didn't mention the dog's name, but I actually don't want to know because that's a private matter. So thank you so much for being here. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify on the bill? Or anyone else online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 160? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is now closed, and we will hold the bill to get some of those questions answered, and if you could let the sponsor know. Thank you so much, Dr. Linnemuth. Next, we have House Bill 18, and I'd like to invite the sponsor forward. This is a race classic bill. It was introduced by Representative Ortiz, and please feel free to present the bill. We do have about a half hour left in the committee, so, and we have several members online, but not a lot, so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36.
And for the record, my name is Liz Harpold. I am staff for Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for agreeing to hear HB 18. This bill should be a lot simpler than the last one. It's necessary for the eligibility of the Ketchikan Greater Chamber of Commerce to obtain a race classic permit. Categorized race classic is so narrowly defined in statute, providing only for the Mount Marathon race classics held by the Seward Chamber of Commerce. The Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce also has an interest in obtaining a race classic permit for a human race, the Race to Alaska, which is a human-powered boat race beginning in Port Townsend, Washington, and ending in Ketchikan, Alaska. This bill was heard in front of Senate Community Regional Affairs, and there it was amended so that the bill now also expands the scope to allow other communities the opportunity to permit race classics. To my knowledge, there's only been like two permits requested in the last 18 years or so for this type of a thing, but nevertheless, it's needed. This bill is needed so that the Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce can sponsor their own race classic again between Port Towns in Washington and ending in Ketchikan, Alaska. Pretty straightforward.
Thank you, Representative. And I don't see anybody online from the administration. I actually did have some questions related to games of skill and chance and the history of why, you know, of this effort. And perhaps you could – oh, you are
– I believe we have Ms. Mitchell in the audience here from the Department of Revenue.
Okay, they're not signed up, so it's hard for me to tell. So okay. Thank you. Okay. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Meyer?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at – So the version before us is the Community Regional Affairs version. Is that correct? Okay. And it looks like they broaden, as you said, what a race classic is. Yeah. Does that concern you that we could have all sorts of basically gambling going on?
I know it's in the position of the chamber that they would rather not have that amendment there. However, I think it was in the interest of the former, of the chairperson of Community and Regional Affairs to make it so that you wouldn't have to have this kind of thing keep coming up in front of the legislature. So she, I believe it was the intent to broaden the scope so that you know, bodies like this wouldn't have to hear about minor events like this. There you have it. There's a concern that, you know, perhaps more people might want to piggyback on this particular race with that amendment being there. So there is a concern, but the sponsor, I'm willing to see the bill move forward even with the amendment.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. And like you said, there really only has been a couple that have come before us in the last 10 or so years. So it doesn't happen too often. It just appears like the definition is pretty broad that would allow maybe some things to happen that we don't necessarily want to happen. But let me give that some more thought. Thank you.
And perhaps some Ms. Mitchell from the department would be able to comment more fully on that.
Okay.
I also share that concern. I think that there are protections and there's a reason why the legislature goes through and approves. And if we just open up the floodgates, I'm not sure we are knowing what we're opening it up to. And so I'm Katrina Mitchell is here from the Department of Revenue Tax Division, and thank you for being here. We'll probably get some information from her, but are there other questions? Senator Michiki?
Madam Chair, I support the line that you've both approached. Of course, the Mount Marathon Race Classic is in my district in Seward. I would prefer that we add the individual. I would feel better about that. Just I come from land of salmon derbies, and until we did a specific permitting system, it became ridiculous. I mean, I support the bill. Well, I support your original intent, I think, more so than so that's my only comment at this time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And so we'll have Katrina Mitchell come forward, please. Thank you.
Chair.
Oh, Senator Meyer.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Ortiz, if we were to go back to your original version, that you'd be okay with that, I'm assuming?
I'd be perfectly fine with that.
Okay. And it sounds like whoever made the amendment in CRA would still like to see it go through with or without that amendment as well. Is that what I heard you say, or am I putting words in your mouth?
Could you repeat that question again, Senator?
Okay, I think you said that it was amended in Community and Regional Affairs.
On the Senate side, that's correct.
Okay, yep, it was. So, okay. But I think, did you say that the person who made this amendment would still like to see the bill go through with or without the amendment? You don't want to speak?
I can't comment on that.
All right, thank you very much.
I'm going to take a brief at ease.
So the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order, and if Katrina Mitchell could come forward with the Department of Revenue. Thank you, Ms. Mitchell, for wading through today's hearing on different bills. I think you've heard the question, at least my question is, could you just give us the, 30,000-foot view of why it is that classics have to come before the legislature in the games of skill and chance, and why there's this, I guess you would call it just a level that communities have to go through in order to have it approved, and then what it would do if, you know, the previous version that came before us, where it just opened it up for any community, if there's any concerns that the administration has or any thoughts that you might have about that.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Katrina Mitchell, and I manage the charitable gaming program within the Department of Revenue. So first, let me just talk about classics in general. Statute defines a variety of classics. Some classics are limited to where only certain organizations are allowed to conduct them. Lots of name recognition. For example, the Nanana Ice Classic. We all know about it. We love it. It's got recognition, right? But there's other classics. For example, the Crane Classic, that anyone can do a Crane Classic. It's not limited to a certain organization. So does that answer part of your question?
Somewhat. So can you talk more about the Crane Classic? What is it, and that was passed in statute, and then how many communities partake in that, or organizations?
Okay, so a Crane Classic is defined as a game of chance in which a prize of money is awarded for the closest guess of the time of arrival of the first sandhill crane to a particular place. So basically, you can bet money on when the first crane is going to land wherever at Kramer's Field. And so any organization that holds a gaming permit may choose to conduct a Crane Classic. However, other classics, the Cabbage Classic, the Deep Freeze Classic, the Goose Classic, there's other classics that were implemented in statute that limit the organization that's allowed to conduct that classic. So, for example, the Cabbage Classic is a game of chance where a prize of money is awarded for the blah, 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 winning cabbage at the Giant Cabbage Way Off at the Alaska State Fair in Palmer, operated by the Palmer Rotary Club. So I wasn't around when these were enacted, but my thought is, the Palmer Rotary Club wanted to have an event to help raise funds for their organization that no one else could come in and say, well, I'm having another Cabbage Classic right down here in Booth B at the Palmer Fair. I'm only speculating as to why some classics are limited to certain organizations and why others are not. But any organization that holds a gaming permit, they could choose to do a Crane Classic or any classic that's not specific to an organization every year if they like.
So does the Greater Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce hold a gaming permit right now, or does this bill allow them to have that permission to do this classic?
I presume the Chamber of Commerce holds a gaming permit already. They probably, I'm just speculating, they probably conduct a raffle or something each year. And so instead of just checking raffle on your permit request every year, you check raffle and Crane Classic, for example.
So is it with the proliferation of events and sporting events and races, do you advise the committee to not expand the scope? Because races are much more popular than the classics that you've mentioned. So is that something that perhaps we would address at some other point? I think I know the reason for the amendment was to take this out of the legislature's purview and just have it be addressed in some other avenue. I mean, we are dealing with budget crises and things like that, and so I think that that's the rationale for perhaps there might be a better way to do this, but I'm not sure that addressing it in this bill is the best way at this point without further ramifications that we look at, because once you open it up to anybody,
It seems like you could almost have someone come in and actually do a raffle for a classic that already exists that someone has a permit for. It would complicate matters, is what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, so only, generally speaking, nonprofit organizations and municipalities are authorized to apply for and hold a gaming permit. Nobody else is allowed to have a gaming permit. So the field is limited to participate, to offering a classic. It's limited just to those organizations and municipalities that hold a gaming permit. And that number is pretty steady. It's about 1,000 permits every year. So when you talk about opening it up to anybody, I think what that means is more than one organization that holds a gaming permit would be allowed to put on some sort of a race classic if they wanted to.
Thank you. Senator Michiki?
Madam Chair, it looks to me like the sponsor's initiative is to have a Race to Alaska Classic operated and administered by the Greater Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce. Not sure that he's probably, his goal is probably not to change the world. I don't know if we've been through this section or Title V on how many different types of, it's interesting reading. there's 49 different types of really fun ways to raise money in Alaska. So like I can just tell you that if that's his objective, I would support adding a B and moving along if that's your goal, Madam Chair. If not, I...
Senator Michiki, when you say adding a B?
Well, actually, going with version A.
You mean adopting version alpha and passing that from committee today?
Yes, ma'am.
Does anyone in the committee have an issue with that? Okay. So considering the time that we have left, my intent to move the bill. It looks like we have just one individual here in the room who'd like to testify. Why don't I go ahead and open public testimony, allow Chelsea Galsher to provide brief comments, and then if there's anyone else online, and then we'll look to the will of the committee. So thank you very much for your patience in answering our questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chelsea, if you'd like to come forward. Go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 18, version alpha.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Senators, for the opportunity. My name is Chelsea Goucher. I'm the current president of the Board of Directors for the Ketchikan Chamber and actually a former executive director, so I also worked for the Chamber. And I can tell you that in Ketchikan, this bill would be very helpful to us. Our chamber is almost completely funded through memberships. We get very limited money from any of the local governments in Ketchikan. Ketchikan has had an economic development fund with the borough, which is dwindling. We don't have a separate economic development nonprofit or entity like JEDC, for example, here in Juneau. So a lot of that work falls to the chamber, and we work with a budget of under $200,000, which is pretty amazing for a community our size. So the ability to raise money through charitable gaming is a really big deal to us. We've done a lot of important work to topics that are probably kind of dear to this committee's heart, including maritime workforce development. We're working on initiatives right now regarding healthcare, pricing transparency, of course, support for resource development, particularly in the timber and mining sectors. And most recently, we're working on an initiative to attract tech workers who are looking for a different lifestyle and a different place to live, to consider Ketchikan and Southeast Alaska as a place that's a lot closer to some of the tech hubs than maybe Blaine, Washington on the I-5. So given all of that and what we try to do with a very limited budget, this bill would absolutely help our organization specifically to reach that end and allow us to capitalize on the Race to Alaska, which is a very cool race between Port Townsend and Ketchikan. No engine power is allowed. It has to be either, rowing or sailing. And it's a race that's garnered national attention for adventure and sports enthusiasts. And it's great for our economy. The Visitors Bureau hasn't supported it. Obviously, the hotels, the restaurants like it. I work for Alaska Marine Lines. We're shipping a lot of the boats back south. So it's a good boon for our economy, and we just want to capitalize on a little bit for our chamber specifically so that we can get some of that money that's generated by the buzz around the race and use it to put back into the economic development we're trying to do for Ketchikan.
Thank you very much, Chelsea.
You're welcome.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Chelsea. Chelsea, so if I understand your testimony, you don't really care which version passes. You just want a version to pass.
Not necessarily. I mean, I understand the concerns on both sides, but yes, the original version A is what we asked our representative to put forward.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here in the room or online that wishes to testify on House Bill 18? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed.
Can we have brief at ease, Madam Chair?
Brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 18, Version A, be adopted as our working document before the committee.
Is there any objection to Version A being before the committee? Okay, so moved. Senator Meyer.
Okay, Madam Chair, you ready to move the bill? Madam Chair, I move House Bill 18, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, is there any objection to House Bill number 18 of Version Alpha, moving from committee with individual recommendations, and then the fiscal note will change in the next committee if need be? Okay. Seeing none, so moved, and thank you very much, Representative Ortiz and your staff. The committee is adjourned.